And welcome to another exciting episode of Kick Arts, Auckland's comprehensive art show, brought to you every Sunday night here at Planet FM 104.6 or live stream planetaudio.org.nz. Call Richard Green, 10A. I'm your host for the next 90 minutes, along with my co-host, Georgia, who smells like beer because she's been watching a boxing match, apparently, in a pub.
I didn't have any beer, though.
You didn't have any beer? Well, that would be irresponsible when you've got to come to work.
And to be honest, it's one of those things when you're sober and everyone else is drunk and you go, man, I'm glad I haven't been drinking.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of makes me feel like maybe more Sunday afternoons on the couch in my slippers.
Watching perhaps the boxing.
I actually really enjoyed it.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. It's not the kind of thing. I'm not a sporty person. You won't be surprised to hear, but it was really fun.
Yeah, it's an art form of itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
So all that dancing around and dodging and ducking and cuddling and holding.
It was cool.
I already saw straight away somebody had posted on a meme.
Yeah.
Is that right? Did I get it right that time? Okay, because it's not a meme, is it? Because I was calling it a meme for a while and my children were laughing at me. But a meme of one of the boxers cuddling the other boxer, and then below it was the Titanic. Yeah. The on the bow with Leonardo DiCaprio holding
Kate. It's quite intimate, yeah.
It is quite intimate.
And McGregor was a good loser. You could just tell he was just
I haven't
stopped.
Seen it. I don't know who won or lost, thanks.
I'm sorry. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, I just was one of those
people.
Okay, just to let you know that Bruce Willis is actually dead in the... I forgot the name of the movie now. I just ruined my own joke. Help me out, someone.
Now it just sounds like breaking news that Bruce Willis is dead.
In The Sixth Sense.
I legit feel real bad for everybody. I just spoiled it.
Yeah. Hey, I reckon that our demographic probably didn't watch the fight. But hey, welcome. And thanks for rushing from your boxing match. That was great because we've got a really full studio and I need your help. So, co-hosting, Googling stuff, and all sorts of things.
No, it was more, well, I had to go home and do some work, and then it took me longer than usual.
Oh, we don't need the whole story.
I didn't get changed, and that's why I smell like beer, everyone.
Okay. Wow, this is a really...
You are welcome to that story.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for coming. Okay, in the studio, we've got some real guests, of course, coming up again this year is the Go West Writers Festival, which has had a few, an interesting couple of weeks. Going West Writers Festival, yes. It's unlike the bus, which is Go West, isn't it? Do people get confused with that at all? Is that a common mistake, or is it just me?
I think if they get the bus to Going West, that's fine.
Yeah,
if they accidentally get on the Go West bus and it takes them to the right destination,
that's good. Excellent.
And if they're a literary type, they might realise that there's a link to the Morris G novel.
Oh, wow. Well, I didn't know that, so I'm learning something every single day. But welcome back.
Thank you.
It's lovely to be here.
And also welcome back to the studio, Brendan Green, comedian. Awesome last name. Just fantastic.
Yeah, great last name. Back, Mr. Green.
So very must be, like, related somewhere down the line, perhaps.
I reckon. I was really disappointed last time I came for the interview. You weren't here. I had to talk to Georgia the whole time.
I know.
That's really mean.
And look how that worked out.
Yeah. And now she has to sit as far away from me as possible.
I know.
That's
at the other end of the studio.
Mean.
But welcome back, because you're doing the greatest show on earth at the moment, aren't you?
We're about to kick off the best comedy show on earth, which is not false advertising.
No, it's not. Is
that
it?
That's really good. Guaranteed.
Yeah. And it's going all over the country.
Yeah, upper North Island, lower North Island, and South Island.
No way.
There's a new idea.
Yeah, the South Island gets comedy.
Oawamaru
Oawamaru. It's one of our stops.
What's the venue in Oawamaru?
I can tell you exactly this. It's the Oawamaru Opera House.
Wow, there's an opera house.
You have to sing.
It's an entirely musical performance.
Oh.
It's going to be terrible. Do not go to that one.
Well, speaking of musical performances, I'm known on the show for not liking musicals. We all know that. It's quite famous. Richard Green hates musicals. Richard Green went and saw Matilda this week. I'll be talking about that. I'll be doing a little bit of a review on Matilda the musical. I've even got all the books. So that's really quite cool. I like blue. That's a good colour. It's a good colour on me. Okay, and then we have Aroha and Jason, who are part of the Kōanga Festival, and which is also part of the Going West Festival.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's a connection here already.
A little bit of a partnership.
A partnership with Te Pau?
Yes.
Yeah. And because there's quite a few events going on at the Poe, as I understand it. Yeah. And you're part of a new program funded by Creative New Zealand for new playwrights.
Yeah, it's really exciting to what we're involved with is they've chosen four playwrights to develop their new works with dramaturgs and a director and a cast. And I think it's a real luxury as a playwright to have that, you know, to be able to pay people to develop your work.
Yep.
We've got people like Gary Henderson as dramaturgs, the director for my play is Jennifer Ward-Leland.
Oh, wow.
So we've got a high calibre of creative people, plus the actors too. So Jason and I are two of the four playwrights. The other two is Mariah Rakuraku, who's in Wellington, and Crystal Lee Brown. And I think it's just exciting to Te Pau have taken that that challenge to make sure that there are more Māori voices in theatre, because there's a lack of that at the moment.
There certainly is. And it's good that actually funding development is unusual in New Zealand, isn't it? Because most groups have to actually put on a performance and then get an audience and then bring it back to redevelop it and do that a few times before the final work comes out. We see that quite a bit at some of the smaller venues around. Fantastic. And welcome back to Jason.
Thank you.
And you've been in here before as a musical director, because you're quite a musical director of some renown. Is that the word? Is that a correct word?
Oh, that's very kind.
Yeah. And so writing a play.
Yeah, so it's actually my first play that I've ever written. So I've been pretty lucky to be picked up by Te Pau to workshop the work. I've done lots of musical work. I didn't even know that you didn't like musicals that much.
Usually comes up.
So my career's been mainly in on stage or as a musical director, and you know, it's a kind of natural next step to write a piece that has been kind of burning inside me for a while and wanting to get it on the page and get it on the stage and see what happens.
We're looking forward to hearing about what that piece is and the origins of that. And also I'd like to welcome back Dawn, who's here, not as a guest, but as a reviewer, first-time reviewer on Kick Arts. And you went off and saw Danny in the Deep Blue Sea this week, so we'll be hearing about that.
Yes, indeed.
So welcome back to Kick Arts. Now, you've had a bit of a rough couple of weeks, haven't you?
Week.
Nicola and Mark, with the fire at the Titirangi Memorial Hall, the roof was quite severely damaged.
Yeah, they had to cut out about a third of the roof to stop the fire. And so the hall has survived and will be repaired, but not in time for our festival, unfortunately. But there's great news.
Well, the festival's been in the Titirangi Hall for, 15, 16 years, I suppose, of its life. Thanks to lots of work last week, we now have a new venue, and it's going to be in the council chambers at Waitakere Central, which is the council buildings.
Great.
In Henderson, which is right next to the Henderson train station, which is really nice, because going back to where the name comes from, Going West, as the festival name, was inspired by a passage in Maurice G's Going West, which is a train trip from Henderson, or Loomis, as Maurice G used to refer to it in his novels, as sort of his fictional version of Henderson, into Auckland City. So in a weird way, it's kind of going home to Henderson for this year. So
sometimes
that's crisis averted.
Some things happen. That must have been a bit stressful with the festival looming.
It has been a bit of a crazy week, but as one of the people on our trust pointed out, apparently the Chinese character for crisis is also the same as for opportunity. So that's how we're trying to think of it.
Right. That sounds like one of those 90s kind of feel-good promotional things that they used to do at workshops and stuff with staff. Yeah. And let's take crisis and turn it into opportunity. Mm. It's a good idea, though. So, I mean, because it's quite a nice space, if I remember. I've been to a few events there, and it's quite a nice big space, isn't it?
If anyone goes onto our Facebook page, they can watch a guided tour by Nicola through the space.
Yeah. And just Going West is your Facebook. They put Going West into the Facebook search.
Yeah.
It'll come up. They should find it.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. Yeah. A guided tour.
Yeah, there's a huge big Pōtuku Manawa as you approach the building. There's some beautiful art. It was a purpose designed building 10 years ago, eco friendly. Yeah, it's
got a garden on the top. I've been up to the garden.
That's right. Yeah.
Also, a pretty good Gloria Jeans. I've, my two recommendations.
I've been into that Gloria Jeans, and I might fight you over that.
Yeah. Well, there's no need to go anywhere near Gloria Jean's anyway, because we put on the most fabulous catering and great coffee right through the weekend.
Oh, gosh. Sold me straight away. Yeah, I hear the word Gloria Jean's and I hear the word coffee, and the two of them are not synonymous as far as I'm concerned. So, yes, it's like Starbucks and coffee. It's the same kind of
they
deal.
They do a really good hot chocolate. Mm. If you're ever forced to go to Gloria Jean's, it's called their creamy hot chocolate, and I have it every Monday morning.
Oh, when you're every Monday morning, when you're forced to go there.
Forced to go
well,
there.
It's my whole uni class. I'm at the Waitakere campus, which I think is well the part out of the book, the Morris G book that you were talking about. I think there's a mural up in the Henderson train station as well, isn't there?
That sounds highly likely.
Yeah,
I can't confirm that, but it sounds very likely.
He called it Loomis?
Yeah, in all his books he never referred to it as Henderson. He sort of created the semi-fictional version of it called Loomis.
Loomis?
Mm.
Well, I wonder if that's got to do with illumination and enlightenment, maybe.
Mm.
I wonder what the Chinese character for enlightenment is. We could find out.
The Chinese character for Gloria Jean's.
Yeah.
That's quite cool, though, because if people took the train and then they can check it out and then...
They can check out the mural or the coffee.
And the coffee and the hot chocolate.
Yeah. Are you a fan of coffee, are you, Brendan? Does it keep you going as a comedian?
Well, I thought I was, those late and then nights? You guys all talked crap about my Gloria Jean's.
Yeah.
No, I see I'm with Jason here. He's sipping from a BP on the go-cup.
Mm. That's right.
What Smurf did you get? Did you get some petrol?
I got a Smurf, correct, but I don't actually know which one it is.
You've not opened it. Are you going to save it for 20 years?
I opened it, but it's very non-recognisable.
You've got a Smurf.
He's got green hair, which is unusual.
It's really nice that you're talking about Smurfs, because it's just a rehash of stories that have been around for, you know, they just seem to rebuild all the cartoons and the superheroes. They're making them over and over and again. You guys get the opportunity to create something absolutely new, which is quite exciting for New Zealand art. And Māori writers doing Māori work is something that's new as well. It hasn't been supported much over the years. What's it like being at the forefront of that, the pinnacle, the point, the icebreaker, the vanguard? Oh gosh, that's a bit posh.
The prow of the waka.
The prow of the waka.
No pressure.
Yeah.
Well, I think for me, I mean, Māori theatre was kind of had a big resurgence in the 90s of playwrights and really kind of quite hard hitting and impressive works written by Māori writers and, you know, utilising Māori actors and kind of bringing that to the forefront. Most of it was kind of came out of Wellington with Takirua, and there are a lot of plays, you know, that are still kind of revered today as good, solid works of Māori literature in terms of stage and screen. You know, Waiora and Honikoka's trilogy, and Puru Puru Whetū and things like that, that, you know, which is interesting, have come around again very recently. Court Theatre did Waiora not long ago. Puru Puru Whetū has just been around and around the circuit again. And yeah, so it did have a little bit of a lull, I guess. And we have been brought. Well, the Te Pō have picked up the Kōanga Festival, which was originally set up by Don Selwyn in the 90s. And then he got unfortunately unwell. And so the festival never continued after that. So it's kind of been hibernating, I guess.
And a continued legacy.
Yeah, and Te Pō have, you know, taken that big risk and step and with the help of Creative New Zealand, which is amazing, being able to re-platform this Kōanga Festival and then insert the Whakarongo Mai section, which is the playwright component of it.
Now, part of that 90s resurgence, Rauri Paratini was part of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's part of the festival as well, as I understand. Yeah. He's got a piece...
He's got it on the solo show Peter Parker Paratini, and it's his first solo show.
And that sort of, and as I understand it, he's talking about his life and his work.
It's kind of a
reflective
song and stories.
Yeah.
But going back to Māori theatre, I mean, I think my challenge is, you know, I'm a Māori writer, but I don't tend to write on the subject matters that are Māori. Like my first play 3 years ago, Luncheon, you know, it was set in Hollywood, 1958, based on an Academy Award nominee's Best Supporting Actress. And I think, you know, when we talk about Māori theatre, I think another kind of journey for us is to challenge ourselves to write about things that aren't necessarily Māori.
No.
I think there were a lot of when I was trying to shop luncheon around, I got a lot of resistance from a lot of people because it wasn't a mod. They saw the name as the playwright. I think a lot of people who read the play saw it was a Māori writer and kind of had a preconceived idea of what this play should be. Mm. For instance, you know, a company turned my play down, and the advice was the biggest flaw of your play is that you're not writing what you know. You should just stick to Māori stories.
Oh my God! And did somebody put that in writing?
No, I'm just trying to think. It was a while back. It was about 4 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Because, I mean, I knew there was a resistance for people wanting to pick up the play luncheon, and it just kind of confirmed to me that there was this preconceived idea. I mean, I wish I had maybe submitted plays with a false name, maybe a Pākehā name, so people could actually give it a fair go when they read it. It forced me to actually put it on myself, and it ended up being such a successful season. It was Jennifer Ward-Levin and Katie Wolfe directed. They touched it, people came. You know, it's full. So I think that, and so basically that play was about Miyoshi Umeke, who was a Japanese actress who won the Academy Award that year in 1958 for her role in Sayonara. And I wanted to explore racism in that era and use her as an example of what it would be like, her being in the room full of, you know, other nominees.
Yep.
And what I say to people, even though I'm not Japanese and I didn't live in that era, I know what it's like to be different in a room. I think we all can identify with that. I think it being Māori, you can write about other things that are not necessarily Māori, but you draw on your experience. And so I think my second play, Officer 27, there was a Niuean cast. And this play, quite interesting, Provocation. It's about the gay
pattern of defense. This is the one you're doing for the Kōnga Festival? Yes.
Yeah, and we try to, I mean, the characters in this play, so it's basically based on a gay panic defense, which is a provocation defense was back, it was a defense over 100 years in our law, where people who had killed could downgrade their murder charge to manslaughter if they can convince that they lost self-control and were provoked to kill. So, for instance, it was quite common for crimes of passion between married couples, and also when gay men were getting murdered, people would say, well, he...
Hit on me.
Hit on me.
That happened quite recently, even.
A year ago, the trial of Ihaya Harris. Although, so provocation is no longer in law. In 2009, it was eradicated from law because of the Sophie Elliott case. Clayton Weatherston, who stabbed Sophie Elliott more than 200 times, tried to claim that he was provoked. So I think for many years, a lot of the gay community were trying to eradicate this law from, this defence from law, and were unsuccessful, but people kind of saw how ridiculous it was when Clayton Weatherston tried to use it.
Right.
And soon after that trial, it was eradicated from law. So it was an interesting case with this. I mean, any of those characters that I've written could be Māori, but we couldn't. It was our Māori actors at a certain age, because there were two older characters, were busy. There's so much going on for that. George Hinare, we asked. So we couldn't actually... And I wanted one Māori character because it wanted to reflect that it did happen. It happens to, like, you know, all sorts of ethnicities throughout the years. But interesting fact is that we couldn't find one because all our Māori actors of that age were busy and working, which is a good thing.
That's a great thing.
But, yeah, so...
That sounds like a real hard-hitting subject. Bit of comedy in there as well?
It is. It is actually. Well, I find it's really important when you're tackling serious issues, especially in theatre, that there has to be some kind of balance of light and dark.
Yeah.
If it's all dark, we've all been to theatres where it's just really quite dark. And there's no kind of light. Well, I believe anyway is that you need to find a good balance. Because although you want people to feel, you don't really want them to be drained.
No.
So in this play, the two older couple, you know, I've got a point of reference with The Odd Couple, a famous play, so that's what I've kind of inspired by. So it starts very funny, but then as the play goes on, it just kind of revealed these deeper issues.
Is your show dark, Brendan, or is it...
It's almost the exact inverse in stand-up comedy, where you don't
like for good, for well, I believe anyway, good comedy and a lot of comedians, they don't all just want it to be light. You want to chuck a little bit of darkness in there, mm. a little bit, and find a little balance there because it brings something extra out. Mm. But then for comedy, the baseline is it has to be funny. Mm. So this show that we're taking on the road, there's like six comedians on over the course of an hour and a half, so it's pretty much just the best of. So you're not going to get too much pathos going on in there. No big narrative structures or anything. It's just us going out, doing our A game, entertaining the crowd, getting out of there.
Getting out quickly.
Getting out of there. Yeah. Next down. Let's do this.
Hitting the next fight, eh, Georgia?
Because, our creative outlet is the stage and the theatre. And so we use that as a therapeutic way. How do you use comedy for yourself?
Oh, my God, it's so good.
Yeah.
You just go out there and say whatever's on your mind, and then you're shocked at yourself. Sometimes. It is, I think, a lot of people do call it kind of free therapy, or therapy that you get paid for. Yeah, it's really good. So right now I've been writing a lot of stuff about my family. And then with their blessing, I can say it on stage. But it is, because my comedy is very much based on little nuggets of truth, and then you can find the little themes and all the fun little avenues in that, and kind of extrapolate that.
Because real life is funny, isn't it?
When you do when you do those bits, excuse me, based on family members, and this might be a comedy secret that you're about to give away that you're not supposed to. But is it cool to get out there and tell a tale about a member of your family that's only like 20% based in reality, and you just sort of have embroidered the rest for comic value?
Yes. Yep. A lot of people, especially when you're starting out, will do 100% true stuff. But the problem with real life and telling stories that are 100% true is that life very rarely gives you a punchline. Stories don't end well in real life. You can get, like, for most stories that are true that comedians will tell, 90% of them are true, but then you have to come up with an ending to kind of wrap it up in a nice funny bow. So most stories you hear on stage are definitely exaggerated.
Because the partners, and just the partners of stand-up comedians, often the target. Brendan smiles and says, "Yes, yes, of course."
I've got a bit that I do now about catching my girlfriend in bed cutting her toenails.
Right.
Oh, it's really good.
Yeah, which is like the worst thing I've ever seen any human being do.
Cutting toenails in bed. Yeah, that might upset me a little bit.
Yeah. And then at the end, I've added in a little bit, just to add a little extra little bit of truthfulness. I finish the gag and then I say, "My girlfriend hates that I tell that story, but she understands this is what I do for a living. You know, I tell our intimate moments to strangers for money." And for this one, she needs to give her defence. So I actually, she was like, "Oh, I know you have to say this, but..." Like, she gives me a defence to tell the audience, which I then turn into another little joke.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So
we have to come along to see what that defence is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... But I think we can all agree that is indefensible. Like...
Cutting toenails in bed, absolutely.
Yeah.
Cutting toenails in bed. Yeah, that's a bit wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, right? Almost broke us up.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. No, it's not. Confessions at Kukart's at 9 o'clock. Yeah, oh, 8:30.
So my comedy is probably almost as hard hitting as your place, I'd say.
Yeah,
just on different wavelengths, maybe.
Don't let the truth get in the way of a good story, I always say, though. With the Going West Festival, speaking of balance, do you have to find a balance between? So you've got a wide audience, I imagine. So how do you pick what happens within the festival? Because it's only a weekend, and you've got a lot of really good stuff on offer. I bet.
Well, it's actually over several weeks, but the books and writers.
Right, that's what. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've got a lot of theatre on offer as well. Mm. I was just listening to these guys and thinking at Te Pau we've got the Māori Sidesteps.
Oh yeah.
In terms of offering some light, you know, that play on the Māori entertainers of the 60s and 70s and Prince Tuitika and Bileti James. And I haven't actually seen the show, but I've watched a bit of it, and it looks like it's going to be pretty hilarious.
A lot of fun.
Awesome. But
have you also seen it, Jess?
Kororareka, that we're bringing out west as well, a sort of bare bones rendition of the Ballad of Maggie Flynn. And Russell during the Tiriti era, you know.
The hellhole of the Pacific, as it was known, yeah.
Are you going there with your comedy tour, Brendan?
I'm going to where, sir?
Russell.
Russell, no.
No, it's the hellhole of the Pacific.
Said not Russell.
Well, apparently it's a good place now. It's okay. It's not as bad as it was in the 1830s.
There's you're less likely to be shot by a drunken whaler, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
Back to that sort of light and shade, I think that's one of the first filtering meetings we have with, in terms of programming, which writers and books we're featuring, as we sort of have our long list and start to whittle that down. And one of the first things we look for is, are we veering too much into the heavy or too much into the light?
Right.
And trying to find that balance, because that is important. You know, cause it can be quite intense. You're sitting in that room, and if you're coming for the whole weekend and you're seeing four or five sessions in a row, you want that texture. You want that, well, those ones that make you laugh and those ones that make you sort of ponder. And I think part of the joy of the festival is that it's the ones that make you laugh are often the ones that you didn't expect to make you laugh.
Right.
And vice versa.
I notice you've got The Wish Child.
Yeah.
Forgive me, I've forgotten the author's name.
Catherine Jujie?
Yes, so I read that. My wife got it for Christmas from her father, and then she said, you've got to read this one. And I read that, and I was just blown away. And I didn't realise it was a New Zealand author until we had a discussion here on the show about 6 weeks ago. We had someone in the publishing industry on here who said that New Zealand books tend to get forgotten. You know, people tend to read books from overseas, and it's really hard for New Zealanders to get their books published here. But that one, I mean, it was a brilliant book. But I mean, on the international stage, as far as books are concerned, that was one of the best books I've read in a very long time.
That's right, and it was it did get the big fiction award in the New Zealand, the Ockham Awards this year, and rightly so.
Mm.
But very much an international story set in Berlin,
I know,
during the Second World War, and I think told the story filtered through the eyes of children, and there's a really unexpected ending, and it's quite an extraordinary book.
Mm.
And she's going to be in conversation with Sue Orr, and they're good friends, so I think it's going to be a really
good
lovely
session.
Intimate look. And we've heard a lot about the book too, having won an award, and but the thing too, she'll be talking about her new book, which is coming out a month or so later, The Swing of the Pendulum, or The Beat of the Pendulum.
We'll have to get her on the show.
Yeah, and this is quite different. This is a found novel. So she's recorded conversations and text messages and over the course of a year, and then she's used all of that material to write the book. So it's such a departure from a book about the Second World War and Nazi Germany.
Who did she record? And the text messages?
That's what we're going to find
out. She got a whole lot of them from Bill English, I heard.
459 of them. Yeah. I did not. Yeah, I didn't know anything about that. Yeah. Well done, Mark. Yes.
I'm auditioning to see if I can join this road trip with you.
So far you're doing well. That's the funniest line in the show.
He's the light, I'm the shade. Yeah.
Well, just going back to what Aroha you were saying about being told to write what you know, and, you know, Māori writer writing Māori stories. That story is set in Germany in World War II through the eyes of children by a New Zealand author. I mean, I wonder if anyone had told her, you should write what you know. Sorry. Be interesting to see what reaction she gets as a New Zealand author. Do you know if she's...
Yeah, no, that would be a good question to come from the audience.
Mm.
Perhaps someone wants to come along and ask that.
Well, maybe. Maybe I could come along and ask that question, because it poses that, you know, that from what you've said, it makes a very interesting question, how different people are perceived and asked about their work based on who they are.
Yeah, that's right. I know she's spent quite a lot of time living there. So and did a lot of the research and source material while she was there. But that's right, absolutely. Yep. She's down here in the South Pacific writing about Germany.
And we've drawn our own experiences, and, you know, the lens that she lived in Germany. You know, I'm fascinated with Hollywood, you know, grew up like that. So, you know, we shouldn't be pigeonholed to, because we're more than the colour of our skin. We're more than, you know, our culture.
I'm just interested if someone told J.R. Tolkien to write about what he knows.
Well, what I was just going to say is that, yes, we have experiences and we have our backgrounds, but we also have imagination. Mm. And I think right now that there's a big push in the arts. I'm not sure where it's coming from, but I've felt it in the last year while I've been creating work, that I have to be so aware of my audience. But if I have something in me to create, doesn't that mean that there's also an audience ready to receive it?
Mm.
And if that can come from my experience or my imagination, then doesn't that mean there's someone there that's ready from my experience and my imagination? And so I kind of temper that whole thought. Like, do we have to worry so much about the audience? Or is it that maybe we should trust the audience a bit more to have a bigger imagination, to be a bit more open than maybe we've expected them to be?
Let's hear from you on that, Jason, because we haven't heard about your play yet.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, I totally agree that I think, you know, there's... When you write something, it comes from within. I mean, but at the same time, you know, I personally, I really enjoy research and I enjoy reading, and I've always been a reader of fiction and non-fiction, and more recently social media. You know, you get on the Facebook and things pop up that you've never thought that you were going to look at. I'm a sucker for Stumble Upon, which is a website where you just kind of click stumble and it brings something up, and then you say yes, you like it or you don't, and then it starts to refine every website it sends you to that you're just like, wow, you know, four hours later you're still sitting there reading about random things. And but I agree that I think... audience is important, and of course when we write something, we write something hoping that we have a target audience in mind, you know, because we want to be able to sell that story when we eventually put it up on the floor. But yep. At the same time, it comes from within, and you, the way your head works in terms of telling a story, you know, you end up going on a tangent sometimes, and that's I find the hardest part at the moment, particularly with my first work, is, you know, we've got a deadline tomorrow, both of us, to get our scripts in.
Oh, and so you're here. That's so lovely.
We'll use you as an excuse.
Yeah.
We were on the radio.
We might both be asking for an extension.
We had a media call.
We're going to brainstorm something. Let's do this. We can have a workshop here.
You know, but it's you get a little bit, and then you read it, and you think, yeah, this is good, and then you continue that thought, and then all of a sudden there's a whole new idea that you're like, oh, God, I didn't think of that. Mm. So you kind of have to rein it in and try and pull it together and keep on track. And saying that, my piece is called Little Black Bitch, and it's a thriller. So the basic synopsis of it is it's about a boy called Rangi who discovers a stray dog following him around, and his mates, thinking they're funny, call it Toto. And so he kind of starts to notice her, and then he does the only natural thing, and he adopts her, Whangai. But the more that he feeds her, the more of a bitch she turns into, and his toto, which is blood, his blood starts to run deep and darker than it ever was before.
Oh, sounds like a Stephen King novel, doesn't it? The way he's that little synopsis, I love it. But where did that idea come from?
Well, it's as you may have picked up, the little black dog of depression is the kind of overall umbrella of it. Mm. And, you know, touching on what Aroha was saying before about Māori theatre and what is Māori theatre, or what is a Māori playwright, and what does that, you know, therefore, what are the expectations of you? I think this play is not necessarily Māori as a concept, but then socially, and, you know, we know today that New Zealand has one of the highest rates of suicide in the world, particularly among young Māori men. Mm. And so that, to me, was something and a real drive for me to write it. It's been sitting in me for a while, this story. And then a close friend and colleague of mine took her life last year, and that really kind of inspired me to go, you know, I have to get this on the page and on the floor and out there, and let's start talking about this thing, you know, and rather than hide away and not allowed to use the word and that sort of thing, to open it up and just talk about something that's really, really topical and common, and it's there and it's not going away.
And it comes up a lot in the show because it affects the arts industry quite considerably. I don't know, I have no research on it, but it seems that the arts industry seems to have quite a high level of mental health illness, depression, high rate of suicide, because it's a hard profession to be in. And you're relying on other people often to make you feel good from your success and your work, and you know, it's, you get critiqued. I think it's the only profession where people can actually write something in the newspaper about how terrible you are and get away with it, you know, really.
Politicians.
Oh, and rugby. Yeah. And rugby. Yeah, politicians, yeah, they deserve it.
They're not us poor artists, are
they? We don't get paid $265,000 a year to be here. Yeah, but it's a really important subject, and as you say, we need to have that conversation. More and more plays seem to be being written in New Zealand around this subject. As more awareness around mental health issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the play itself, and the content and the storyline has got nothing to do with performing arts. You know, there's no character in there that is pursuing our career. However, you know, I'm an actor and I'm a musician and a singer, and it, so it's got songs in it. It's not a musical, but it's a play with songs.
It's play with songs. Isn't that what a musical is?
The songs in it are already established Kiwi pop songs, for want of a better phrase. It's a roots Aotearoa soundtrack. So there's reggae and all sorts that has kind of a rootsy feel to it. So there's Maisie Decker and Stan Walker songs at the moment that are on the list. You know, but even Brooke Fraser, it's a bit of Crowded House, those kinds of artists with a bit of a twist in terms of how they're arranged.
Well, I was going to play a track from Matilda because it was relevant to what I did this week, but I'd actually rather play some New Zealand music. So maybe you could tell me what your favourite song is out of you, and I'll try and see if I can get it.
Oh, God, that's a bit hard.
Could be Blind Spot? No, just probably just me on that one. I've actually been going through some old New Zealand music and just what I used to listen to at high school, and there's some really good stuff.
Is Blind Spot on your play?
No. One of the songs that I'm a bit obsessed with at the moment that I've just been listening to over and over again is on Maisie Dicker's most recent album called Roi Moko, which is the god, Māori god of earthquakes and volcanoes, and it's a duet with Anika Moore.
Right.
Yeah, so that's a pretty heart. It's just got a really amazing kind of waidua to it, or a spirit in the song. Nice. That, you know, even though it's recorded and it's been through, you know, that very official format, it just, you feel, you know, Maisie's really amazing like that. You can hear.
What was it called again?
Ruo Moko.
Oh, I found it. Should we play that?
Yeah.
Have a little listen, and then we'll come back and continue our great conversation. And also, we've got to get these reviews out as well. Yes. Speaking of plays with songs. Oh, my goodness. So, yes. Ruo Moko from Maisie Decker.
Yes.
Taki mai ngā wai o wai taki. E re re re.
Gosh, inspired conversation here in the studio. It is like being in a pub watching a fire, I can tell you. Great conversations going on. So this song inspired you to be part of your play with songs. What about this particular song was relevant to the Black Dog?
With Little Black Bitch, when I started to really explore the story and the idea of... I actually kind of saw a production of The Wizard of Oz, and that all of a sudden inspired the Toto idea, which then grew into Rangi Toto and the alignment to the volcano, and that someone with depression, you know, and I, when I say depression, it's such a kind of difficult word to talk about because, what is depression? Is, you know, there's being depressed, which is what a lot of people feel on a regular basis, you know, and that has very clear reasons for things. You know, you might lose your job or something goes really badly in your world, and of course that's going to depress you. But to me, there's a difference when we talk about more of a clinical depression, which is where there's not necessarily a reason for feeling like there's a big cloud over your head all the time. You know, you can be having the best day of your life and everything's going right, but for some reason there's still this cloud. And so to me, that kind of analogy of a volcano that we keep it inside, or particularly someone who is going down the darker path where suicide is an option, where they won't talk about it because they keep it inside. And the more it bubbles away inside, the more likely it's going to erupt, you know. So, and there's often no warning, you know, just like a volcano, it'll just go.
And that is one of the reasons why I think it's really important that there's room for those conversations, so people know they can have that conversation about it. And if we shut it down in the media and say, we're not going to talk about it, which is pretty much what they try and do, then those conversations don't happen and those people don't get the support that they need. It seems ironic that they're saying, don't talk about it, because talking about it seems to be the way to get through it.
Do you see that series they did in the Herald, though, last month? They did I don't know why I was on the Herald site. Don't ask me that.
But. It's a very well-informed, balanced newspaper. That's why. He says...
Said no one ever.
Are you talking about the Break the Silence?
Yes.
Yeah.
Serious, yeah.
Yeah, I saw... I thought the idea was a really great idea, and I saw some of the articles, and I didn't think that it was maybe executed as well as it could have been. But still a great idea,
To have that conversation about
it. Well, it's funny because... Like, it is terrifying to talk about it because, on a personal one-on-one basis, like, you can see logically, it might make sense that if you do talk about it, somebody might learn about it and then do it. Like, if you talk about suicide, that might actually lead someone to commit suicide. And then it feels, I know it's not what it is, but that's what it feels like. And then if that happens, you're like, oh, then that's a little bit on me. Mm. But if you don't talk about it, then there's no personal, it's not on you.
But it's like in young people, we've got the highest suicide rates in the OECD. So it's like people already know about it, so we might as well talk about it because the problem's already here.
Yeah, yeah. I think
it's
that's
like a preventative measure when there's nothing to prevent because it's happening.
Yeah.
I think that's been a big part of the conversation lately, and people like Mike King, you know, getting very vocal about, no, we have to talk about it because not talking about it hasn't really worked.
Hasn't really worked.
Yeah. We've got the highest rates in the world.
Yeah.
So maybe try something different.
And it's tied in a lot. I saw the Commissioner for Children speak at a conference a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about the high rates of bullying amongst young people, and there's a correlation, he believes, between the bullying and the suicide, because it's acceptable behaviour to mock people for who they are or to put them down for who they're not or whatever. And they see a real link between that. We have one of the highest rates of bullying in our schools around the world as well. But, you know, researchers, we're about 20% of children feel like they've been bullied, whereas the average on the OECD is around 10. So we've got to half what we're doing just to even get down to that. So, yes.
And I think, too, you know, a big part of my kind of journey is I've always had a little issue with really common phrase that is used a lot, you know, and as I've got older as an adult, I've got seven nephews, you know, and they're all crazy and typical boys. But often the phrase used in, particularly in New Zealand, is to encourage growing up a bit quicker, you know, and with modern day kids, you know, there is that social media, so there's they do grow up quicker. And then there's the phrase, if you act like an adult, I'll treat you like an adult. You know, when a kid's playing up or something like that, which is really common, and it kind of makes sense, and you think, yeah, yeah, that's cool. However, what doesn't go alongside that is if you have a problem, then we understand that you won't be able to solve that like an adult because you're not an adult, so you can ask for help.
And isn't it agreed now, I think, that adolescence ends at 26?
Yeah.
So actually, you know... Yeah, you've still got another year to go.
Still forming.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Still going.
There's also a phrase that I think is even more dangerous is that we tell our men, especially our young boys, is toughen up. Yeah. You know, we say, oh, toughen up, but, you know, I think that's just as dangerous because, you know, that doesn't acknowledge the fact that, you know, our men, you know, most of those statistics are young men. And we're not giving them the tools to be able to be themselves or to express themselves or to ask for help because we've still got this culture to toughen up.
And arts, apart from being entertaining, has a duty, do you believe, to have these conversations? A duty or a responsibility or actually should we just keep things to be light and happy and entertaining? How do you see the arts in this conversation?
Well, I think, comedy is such a... like a specific form of art, but I think comedy has the responsibility to keep things talking. You can't change anything with comedy, but you can get things into the public sphere and continue conversations, start conversations. I don't think stand-up comedy will offer any solutions, and I don't think anybody should expect that.
Because often it goes the other way, doesn't it? It goes to the extreme other end.
So quite a lot in the past of stand-up comedy is to agitate and to really push like the boundaries on any which way, like up and down, left and right.
I don't think stand-up comedy has ever been as popular as it is now in the United States because there's just so much material.
Yeah, people need to laugh. I think that's something like, you know, the ancient Greeks, they understood that. People need to laugh, people need to cry, people need to get excited. And that's what arts, you know, we just reflect those needs. We make that available for people to come and experience, whether it's film or it's stand-up or it's dance or it's theater, whatever it is. You know, people need those things, and we provide those things because we're people who need those things, so they're the things that we create. But I think laughter, like, man, I don't know how many times laughter has helped me out of a tough spot, you know? And so I think what comedians do, especially when you're using these stories that are from your lives, I think it's awesome, you know? And I think it is really helpful, and I think there are a lot of people who need it, and they respond to it. And yes, Americans, hell, we need it right now.
So Daddy in the Deep Blue Sea, laughter?
Yeah. There is a bit. You know, Shanley, I was just thinking as all this was floating around, I wrote down, you know, Shanley has been viciously having these conversations since the 1980s. And he does it with a lot of humor. And this cast did a really great job, and Sarah Wiseman in her directing, she did a really good job of finding the humor in Shanley's rather dark work, because it's a very dark comedy that he writes. And they found that, and I've seen American casts not find that. We find I can't cuss yet, can I? We're really good at finding the fucked upness in Danny and the Deep Blue Sea, but we don't always find the humor in it. And so this cast, they did a good job of that. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, shall I? Okay. So Danny and the Deep Blue
Sea. That
was
my segue.
Yeah, there's your segue. Got it. Danny and the Deep Blue Sea is over at the basement right now, and it is there through the 2nd of September. I have a little scale that I like to go off of when I review. And it's a 1 to 5 scale, 1 being what the hell did I just see and why, 5 being can I please see that every day, and I'd give this production about a 3.5. Solidly, and I will say a lot of that is because of the beauty of the writing that is John Patrick Shanley. It was good to see him at the basement. It's been a while. Like, when I first got here, I remember being really in love with a lot of the theater I saw, but feeling a lot of times like I just was let off the hook all the time. And I felt like maybe that's a little bit of like a millennial thing. Maybe that's a little bit of a hipster thing. So it was nice to go in and see Shanley and just have to watch something that was really animal and really vicious and in a really cool way. The set, I'll start there, just so you know, the first thing you do when you come in, of course, is see the set. It's nice and simple. It's basic. You've got a bar and you've got a bedroom. Thank you. Sarah Wiseman said in her notes that she wanted to keep it in the 80s. I didn't look at the set and go, wow, this is the 1980s. And she said she wanted to do it to harken back to a time when people were a little bit more connected because we didn't have smartphones and things like that. Which it worked. Hey, I get that. Just like out of preference, I would have said, but why not put it now so that it's relevant now and we can see how we can connect now? I didn't see any reason to keep the playback in the 1980s. They had real cool soundscaping, which I know that sounds like a little bitty thing to notice, but I think it was important because when you're in New York City, and of course Shanley puts the stuff in New York City, there is never silence. There's always sound. There's always something that you hear. And so I thought that was like lovely that they paid attention to that and that it existed within the play.
Sounds a very important part of a show, I think, gets missed quite a lot.
Yeah.
The soundscapes.
Yeah. And it served the play really, really well. So as far as the acting goes, actors were Jodie Hillcock. She was playing Roberta, and Frank Burrell as Danny. Shanley tends to write Irish-Americans or Italian-Americans. These guys are Italian-Americans. They're hanging out in the Bronx. It's the world of this play. First part of the play takes place in a bar. And I would say I feel like the actors maybe had a little bit of opening night nerves. The accent was a bit wobbly. The connection was a bit wobbly. But as they went, they got there. Second bit of the play starts taking place in the bedroom. And in the bedroom, I think the actors really started to hit their pace, really find those characters. The accent issues started to kind of go away. And by the time they got to the third bit, I was really glad I was there to see the play. And I thought, you know, the actors, they did a good job. I would say one of the things, probably I always like to say nice things first and then things that could be better the second. The nice things were, like I said, the comedy and that they found it. I really thought that Frank Burrell's take on Danny was interesting because a lot of times when I've seen Danny, he's always like this really big jacked up guy. And he has to be because, you know, he's got this violence and stuff to him. That's the whole thing about Danny. But by the end of the play, there's like this real like love to him. And there's this different side that you don't see at first in the bar. And Roberta has this line where she's saying, no, we can't do this. If we stay together, you'll be bouncing me off the walls. And most of the time with Danny, I'm like, yeah, he might be bouncing you off the walls. He looks a bit scary. But with Frank Burrell's Danny, I actually felt for him in that moment like she had missed him somehow. Like she had missed that isn't actually the truth of him. And so I thought that was interesting. It was an interesting take that I hadn't seen on the character before. My big bleh with the play would have been, and probably why it didn't get a little bit higher for me, was that there was a lot missed in transitions. There's so much said, you know, as actors got to move from like this reason to that reason, you know, from that intention to the next intention. And I felt like some of those things got really rushed and there's like really big, deep changes in this play. And so that worked. And again, that could have been nerves, but it's something that you definitely don't want. You don't want to hit Shanley real nervous because there's so much done within his transitions. Mm-hmm. Directorially wise, there's a sex scene transition basically, and look, he writes animals. These two characters, they're very much animals in many ways. And you have to hit the comedy, that dark comedy, and you have to hit that animalism if you want the humanity of the play to pay off. And in the sex scene, it was so tame. And not like I needed it to be like porn, but man, Danny and Roberta, it would be like porn. And it wasn't anything. It didn't turn it on its head and make it really sweet and gentle. It didn't keep to what I would have expected of it. It was just kind of a meh into the scene. And I thought there was a big miss in that. And then again, transitioning from the first bedroom part to the second bedroom part, there's this big change. And I just felt like, it got missed. And I think it got rushed to go for the laugh. And because they went for the laugh, there was a lot of moments missed that would have wrapped it up nicely at the end of the play. So, but overall, yeah.
Go and see
kudos
it.
To them. Overall, yeah, definitely go and see it. You know, go and see just a guy who's been the playwright's been writing since, you know, the 1970s, and he's amazing. He's won a Pulitzer, so it's good writing, really good acting, and I'd say, like, really confident directing. So, yeah.
Cool.
Good.
Thanks.
Yeah.
That's good. You watched it carefully, didn't you?
Come review one of my shows. It's awesome.
And I was there that night too, and I think your review is right on the money. Thank yeah, you. Definitely.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, you can help me with my one now, Aloha, because I don't like musicals.
Well, talk about money.
Yeah,
how much money was spent on
my God,
that
it was
musical,
just
Matilda.
Yeah, yeah, Matilda was. I mean, I went along. I took my 9-year-old daughter along. She's been a fan of. I mean, she's a big fan of Roald Dahl, and so when we've been hearing about this musical for months and months and months from her, and I surprised her by taking her because we got review tickets, and she was going to come and review tonight, but she was just a bit overtired from the week, and. I walked in there and just the atmosphere of walking into the Civic. I love the Civic Theatre. There's something about that place that's just magic. You know, yeah. The history, the ambience, the sky, the stars. It's just beautiful. So I was in a good mood to start off with, and I was apprehensive about it because I was thinking how I feel about watching musicals. And I've been to some, you know, overseas. I've been to Les Mis and. The other one, I can't remember the name, but I blocked them out. So I've been, you know, all around the world, been to different musicals and stuff, and I thought, I was apprehensive about whether I would like it or not. I started to get anxious. And I looked down and my daughter was just sitting there munching on her ice cream, which she never gets, and her packet of Pringles, which she never gets, just looking at the set and looking at the letters that are made up all over the set and just making out words. And so chilled and so relaxed. I went, okay, I just got to calm down. And then it started. And straight away, the music, slick. The movement, my God, the dancing was just absolutely slick and incredible. Had me hypnotized from the beginning. And the kids, these kids are 10, 11, 12 years old. And the way that they danced and sang and moved, so professional. But then when you talk about the money that's involved, the crew, you know, you do a musical here, you got a musical director and a dance coach, you know, pianist, rehearsal pianist, and the director and the designer. You've got 5 pages of people who've, you know, dance coach for this person and dance person for this and assistant dance person and assistant pianist to their pianist and things. It's just an incredible array, and that's why it's so slick. And that's why it's won so many awards, I think, internationally, because it is really slick, well done. The characters were great. The story wasn't true to Roald Dahl. I think that kind of the narrative was a bit thin. That's just my opinion. But, I mean, in my view, musicals, the narrative's always a little bit thin. So, you know, it's nothing new to me. But you talk about transitions. Everyone was involved with the transitions, including the kids. And it just kind of moved through, and it was really smooth. The headmistress... Trunchbull. Beautiful. Loved that character. Really did. If I wanted to be in a musical, that would be the part I'd want to play. So much fun. I mean, I cannot actually... I mean, if we use your scale, and this will surprise a lot of people, I'd be giving it around about a 4. 4 to 4.25, because I'm a bit more specific. The thing that I was amazed. I left there, and it was 2.5 hours long. Which, you know, that stressed me out just even going in the first place. How the hell am I going to sit in the Civic for 2.5 hours with a 20-minute intermission? I did. It went by really, really quickly. Really, really enjoyed it. I found, and this may be a musical thing, I don't know, but the kids were so technically perfect, some of the emotion was missing. So they'd obviously been drilled in elocution and to the point where they spoke so well and they hit every consonant, and it was, you know, that's sometimes I felt the heart was lacking in it. And there's 4 different Matildas, so it'd be really interesting to see how they all perform differently. Which Matilda, do you remember which one you saw? Do you know?
No.
There's a New Zealander in there as well.
I think she was Aboriginal.
Right.
Yeah. The one that we saw.
She was obviously very well trained, but and they weren't. Some of them was their first professional debut, but they were just. It was just a little bit too technical for me. I just wanted to see a little bit more heart from them. But they're again, they're 11. You know, I can't. I really feel bad even saying that. I know.
To be honest, I think you'll find that with an adult cast in the West End, you know, who have been there for 18 months doing the same show. That, you know, I saw a couple of shows over there recently that I was just like, wow, these actors look like they're on autopilot.
There's
good technique and living in their technique, but that's it. There's no heart, nothing going on.
Yeah, the heart, this is one reason. I mean, I love listening to opera, but I hate watching opera because the performances for me always lack heart. I mean, you can hear the heart in the music, but if I go to an opera, I just have to close my eyes and listen, because I get a better feel out of it than I do out of watching it, watching the actual performances. I would say, I'd recommend to go take the kids. Don't even take the kids, go by yourself. And just, and be lost in the music. And the music is really good. The songs are all fun. There's lots of good comedy. I laughed out loud a couple of times.
The song's by Tim Minchin, who's a genius comedian.
Yeah. I mean, he's done it. It's brilliant. And Roald Dahl's stories and his characters are so, one of the things that bugs me about musicals is everyone's so big. But you have to be in this because all the characters are so big. It's Roald Dahl. And I really like Matilda's dad's suit as well. I wanted it. So it's green plaid, checked. It was awesome. Did you enjoy it?
Well, I had a long day. I work at Māori TV and we had our dawn ceremony that day. So I was up at 3 in the morning. And so I was kind of in the worst kind of wear to watch a musical. But I did. I really enjoyed the production value. Like, this was a wow factor, the lasers. There's this scene where they use the lasers, and seeing the Civic lit up like that was, that in itself was worth seeing the play. But also, I'm a big Roald Dahl fan too, but I felt that it sanitised his humour and his kind of darkness.
Mm.
I just felt that they didn't really go there, because, Roald Dahl's story is really dark but funny. And I felt that. That's what was missing for me. I didn't get a sense of...
I totally agree.
Of his darkness.
Yeah. And what I like about his stories is it talks about children. And children, think about Charlie and Chocolate, all these evil children, but it reflects back to actually the parents of the ones that are driving through. And they were making some comments in this about education, about how it's the parents who think all their children are bloody miracles. Really they're not. They're not all geniuses. But it was... I agree. It was, the production values were incredible. I mean, that's why I would go back and see it again.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to relax a little bit more and be a little bit more, let myself go a little bit more with it, because I was watching so much. And when you're reviewing, you're kind of paying attention to everything, and and spilling your drink on the carpet and stuff is not good, but which I seem to be doing a lot of just lately. But I mean, the girl I saw, Eva Murawski. I can't even say her name properly. So she's from a youth theatre, and it's her first professional show, and she's got the gig of a lifetime, really. Yeah. I mean, they're travelling around the world, or the South Pacific, doing this show for months. They've got tutors who are looking after them. I mean, what a gig for a child. Wouldn't that be a great way to be introduced to the performing arts? Mm. Have you done musicals? Anyone here done musicals?
You have jazz.
My high school did a musical every year, and I was gutted because I'm a terrible singer, like absolutely atrocious. So I never took part in that kind of the performing arts until after high school.
Yeah. I was in a high school musical production of George Orwell's Animal Farm.
Oh, a musical version?
Yes, yes. I had a couple of very interesting teachers who were trying to shape us politically. And so they thought, well, what better uplifting, bright piece of theatre to make than Animal Farm?
Because there was a one-man show of Animal Farm being done about 5 years ago. And it
Four
was...
Four legs good. Two legs bad. Four legs good.
Not far off.
And this is why you don't do musicals, Brendan. I'd just be sticking to the comedy, because that was quite funny. How did you get involved with musicals, Jay? Your background in music, trained in music.
Yeah, so I'm a classical pianist from very early age. My great-grandmother was a piano teacher, so me and my brother started learning from her before I could even walk, really, which was great. And then I kind of did my first musical in Form 1 at another golden intermediate story. It was called Robin and Her Women of Sherwood.
Right.
Was
that because there were more young girls who wanted to be involved in the production than boys?
Probably.
Yeah.
But it was also the centenary of women's...
Suffrage.
Suffrage, maybe. Was it suffrage? Yeah, I guess... I don't even know.
If I work at IT, 1990, yeah, probably be about right.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, and then I just kind of got interested in it and that it was a kind of really cool craft where you could act. You'd tell stories that involved singing and moving and acting, you know, and then explored the plays when I was a little bit older and didn't enjoy them as much. You know, there wasn't that musical element to it. And, you know, to go back to your comment about the soundscape in plays that is often overlooked or, you know, I'm the first person to notice the soundtrack. And it's the same in films. You know, there's this amazing thing that most people don't realise, that when they get emotional watching a film,
that's amazing.
If you took the music out, you probably wouldn't get emotional at all. You know, and then if you hear that music again by itself, you're like, oh, this makes me feel something. And you know,
we all associate songs, don't we, with moments in life?
Yes.
Would I be correct in making a broad general statement? So you hear a song and go, oh, that's when she dumped me. I remember. Yeah. Or that's when I had that moment in my life.
We've got a surprising soundscape in Going West this year. We've got Rod Oram delivering our keynote address on the Friday night, which is the big theme of the weekend. But he emailed me the other day and told me that there's going to be a soundscape behind his lecture and that his daughter is a composer. So that would be interesting.
Rod Oram, the journalist.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So he's going to be talking about how billions of us are going to be able to survive on the planet by 2050. How are we going to do it? So, you know, it's a big, hefty theme. And he's got his daughter
doing the soundscape.
Something, yeah.
Well, that's
it's not all just musicals and films.
No.
It can be lectures, too.
Well, I'm going to wrap up my Matilda review by saying go and see it, definitely. And if you hate musicals, and I said this to somebody, they said, I don't want to go. I'd rather stay at home and pummel myself with a sharp knife. And I said, go and see it because you will enjoy it. You know, and they were taking the children, and he really didn't want to go and was really resistant. I said, you will enjoy this. I don't think anyone could go along and not come out of it feeling a little bit happy and stuff. Because it's quite, you know, it's fun. It's one of those things that's actually there just to enjoy.
Yeah. And it's nice sometimes to see spectacle, because, you know, we're all usually making stuff where we have barely any budget. So, you know, it's like, you know, but when you do get, it's nice to go and appreciate spectacle once in a while.
And the tickets are it's at the Civic, I think it's through Auckland Live. And look at the tickets, because it might be the cost of a small basement production to go and see it. it'd be worth the investment. Now, you've got music in the Going West Festival as well. We were talking about this earlier. So, and you've
following on from Rod on Friday night, we have a jazz trio coming up from Wellington who have been working with Bill Manhire, the poet, for the last decade, and they're doing a performance called Small Holes in the Silence, which is a line from a James Gay Baxter poem. And they've created original jazz compositions around a whole lot of much loved New Zealand poems. So there's Norman Meehan's the composer and the jazz pianist, and then an incredible vocalist, Hannah Griffiths, and a saxophonist is playing as well, along with Bill taking us along for the ride as the MC.
So you've picked a song, Rain, which is based on...
Yeah, this is one of our most famous poems, Honi Tuwhare's poem Rain, and this is the composition that Norman's created.
I can hear you making small holes in the silence. Rain. If I were deaf, the pores of my skin would open to you and shut, and I should know you by the lick of you. If I were blind, there's something special smell of you when the sun cakes the ground, the steady drum roll sound. hear, smell, or feel, or see you, you would still define me, disperse me, wash over me. Wash over me. Wash over me.
I love those last, like, music with his last little piano sting, is that what you call it, or just the chord, and it just sits and hangs there and carries. It's really a nice way to finish a piece of music. And so that, is that being played? This being, there's a concert of this?
Yeah, that's right. As part of our opening night for the whole festival, but the weekend in particular, on the opening night, we've got Selena Tusitala-Marsh, who's just been announced as our Poet Laureate.
Wow.
And she's spectacular live, and she's just released a collection, Tightrope, on Friday. So she'll be performing. And then Rod Oram is delivering the keynote address that opens the weekend, and then that'll be followed by these guys.
Wow.
Playing some jazz.
What a great opening weekend. We'll come back and find out how people get tickets and some more information about that. Georgia, Non-Flower Elements.
Yibble.
Okay, so yibble.
Yibble.
See, adolescence doesn't finish till 26.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Hang on to that.
I'm taking that as encouragement.
Yeah, absolutely, I would.
Yeah. So I went and saw Non-Flower Elements this week, which was a performance put on at the Basement by Arlo Gibson and Ash Jones, who I am a big fan of both of them. So as soon as I saw that they were doing the performance, I was like, I gotta get there. So I went on Tuesday night. Now, Ash and Arlo are these two quite kooky young men who obviously just have this quite and creative, very strong bond. And you go to their performances and you kind of expect that they're going to have all these in-jokes that they kind of get you involved in, and it's kind of cool and kooky, and you just kind of love watching them be great mates. And they tend to keep the same format, which is that they'll... You go in thinking it's about one thing, but actually it's got a deeper message, and they will break character at some point and do some sort of monologue or very intimate conversation together where you get to find out what the play is actually about. So I saw a play that they did during Saloon Week at the at the Fringe Festival at the Basement, so about 6-7 months ago. So this was like a 15-20 minute piece that was about, like, lost love and distance, and it was a really, really beautiful piece that I enjoyed a lot. The piece that I saw this week I also enjoyed, but I found that the amount of seriousness that they had in the 15-20 minute piece is the same amount as they had in this, what was meant to be an hour long piece but went on for an hour and 40 minutes.
How did that happen?
It just went on and on.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was actually, yeah, that it just, yeah. So it was the characters that they played these two very campy, like from the 70s 80s casting agents. So they started off with you met them, and like you were auditioning for their performance, and you were performing that of Ash and Arlo, and then they spent a lot of time with you upstairs. So if you didn't like audience participation, you would have been very uncomfortable. I'm not such a fan of audience participation. I was quite uncomfortable. I think because I like them so much, I was trying to be like, Georgia, like, get it together, like, this is totally fine, you love it, but I hate it. And it's just like for ages walking around the room, and they're really funny, but to me, if it had just been an hour or 45 minutes and it had been like that amount of the silliness and more, and maybe a little bit more of the seriousness, then it would have been so powerful, because they've got this great message of like this idea that we're all aware that we're connected, and we're aware that we're more than just these socialized ideas, but yet we internalize all of these thoughts that give us so much discomfort and anxiety and just tell us negative things about ourselves all the time. but we know that we're human, you know? And
so if it went for an, so I'm just trying to get my head around it. It was an hour-long piece that went for an hour and 40 minutes. So I'm assuming then that much of it was improvised.
Yeah.
With the audience.
Yeah.
Because I would have left... That would have been me.
Honestly, I
would have left.
I had organised to meet someone at 7:30. It started at 6, and it was like, so I was kind of getting a bit like.
Mm.
And then, like, you know, like, so they do this thing at the end where they took off all their clothes, like they just got fully naked, and then they sung "Kissed by a Rose," which is hilarious and would have been such a beautiful moment of like, yeah, we're human and they're just clothes. But it was like, I've kind of just watched you screw around for like an hour and 40 minutes with like two very short monologues that were, those two monologues were so beautiful and so powerful, and the characters were funny, but it was just too much.
Too much. Yeah.
So then it's like, by the time it got to the end, it was like,
put your clothes back on, I want to go home.
Put your clothes back on. No, I wasn't going that
I had relationships just, like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just, I mean, and who doesn't like Kissed by a Rose?
And sung by two naked men.
And I guess as well, that was, to me, I did actually have some kind of gendered thoughts about it afterwards as well, that if they had been two women, it would have been very different, and it wouldn't have been so, like, boys' club. It wouldn't have been as enjoyable to watch, like, two women because of the way we're socialised. So I thought that was an interesting consideration as well, because it does come across a bit boys' club.
Okay. Is it on still?
It's finished. And I think Ash and Aloe are really great, and I did enjoy it, but I think that if they're going to keep making work, which I really hope that they do, they need to take some messages away from it, because there was a real lack of clarity there, and a good idea isn't enough, you know? Mm-hmm. Less is more.
Yeah.
But if people see their stuff, Ash and Aloe, like, if you see their stuff being advertised, like, definitely go along, because they're brilliant. And they write really
deep. Just make sure it says 15 minutes.
Yeah. Instead of for an hour.
And I think they will learn from it, you know. But,
well, we all learn. We have learning from this part of the process you're going through, isn't it, with this workshop. You're putting a piece out there. It must be hard to put yourself out there too with a new work and go, I hope people like it. Are you worried?
No. Well, I mean, it's always scary, but, I mean, this is my third play, and both my previous plays went through this process. Also, I work as a journalist, so I'm kind of used to producing, churning out work.
Yep. You're in Native Affairs, is that right?
In Native Affairs, but I had a print background in magazines.
Okay.
And in women's magazines, and, that's pretty much, editors can be quite tough. So it's kind of made me, I'm used to editing, I'm used to changing things.
Mm.
So I know in the process of playwriting, it's kind of what needs to be done to get to the level that it needs to be if you want to stage it.
And if people want to see it, guys, where are they gonna see it? What dates is it on?
Yeah, well, tickets? This particular process is a workshop only, so it's not the full season of either work.
So they've got one opportunity to see it?
Yeah, the 6th of September. So there's two plays at the same time. So Aroha and myself are working together. We've got the same
kind of team.
Works on both plays for the 6 days. And at the end of that, which is the 6th, Wednesday the 6th, 6:30?
6:30, yeah.
6:30 is Aroha's play is being read. And at 8 o'clock, my play will be being read.
Will it be under 2 hours and 40 minutes?
It will.
Okay, yeah, just checking.
Yeah. And then the following week, there's Mariah Rakiraku's play, who's from Wellington, and Crystal Lee Brown. Their play will be on
the 13th.
It's the following Wednesday. Yeah,
following Wednesday.
So the 6th and the 13th of September at Tepo.
Yes.
At 6:30, the first play, 8 o'clock the next play.
Mm-hmm.
What's the, do people sit around in a circle and the play reading, or they sit in the audience? Or
I just had a meeting with Amber today, and she said that it'll be in the foyer because it's more intimate.
Okay.
So it'll be for...
Unless, of course, so many people want to come along, then you'll have to move it. Sounds like a fascinating process. And to be part of a process of a new work, it doesn't happen very often as an outsider to come in and actually hear how that works, and then you can follow its progress really and see how it goes.
Also to mention, there is a whānau day as part of the Kwaka Festival on the Sunday the 10th.
10th of September,
So that's for anyone to come along. There'll be lots of entertainment for the whole whānau.
And it's totally free.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. That whānau day is a great day for everyone to go along and see. If you haven't been to the Po Theatre, it's in New Lynn, and it's off Portage Road. And it's in behind the Tannery Cafe, and it's a fantastic venue. It really is, and it does such good work there. So get yourselves along. It's part of the Going West Festival. Mm-hmm. This is the Kwanga Festival, is part of the Going West Festival, which is overarching for lots of other events that are happening as
well.
Yeah,
it is. So, I mean, there's theatre on, we've got a film season on, we've got what's the word I'm looking for? Spoken word.
Yeah. Poetry slam.
Heats,
yeah.
And final. All those things sort of come under the umbrella of the festival. But the core of it all is the Books and Writers Weekend, which is not this coming weekend, the weekend after. So Friday the 8th, Saturday the 9th, Sunday the 10th. Incredible lineup. We've got everyone. We've got Witi Hamada, we've got C.K. Stead, we've got Dame Anne Salmond, we've got Diana Wichita, we've got Steve Brawnius, we've got all the a really diverse range, really incredible bunch of writers there to talk about their stories and how they shape them. And we're pretty excited, especially now that we have somewhere to have it.
Yeah, because you don't have to be sitting under an empty ceiling in a hall. It could have been a bit scary. Yes.
There will be no rain on your head. You'll be nice and dry.
And you can catch the train and the bus, and it's really good. And there's great catering. And if people want to get tickets, how do they get tickets?
They go to goingwestfest.co.nz is our website, and there is links from that through to iTicket, or you just go to
iticket.co.nz and put in Going West Festival. And this is the
22nd year.
That's incredible.
Yeah, we're adults now, but our brain is still, you know, plastic and growing.
We haven't got out of that adolescence.
Well, you're still in adolescence until you get 20. The festival will be out of adolescence at 26. That'll be fantastic. Well, good luck. That sounds like a fantastic array of things that people can go and see. Going West,
there's get something on. For everyone.
There is, it sounds like it. There's something for the family, there's something for adults, there's something for
theatre buffs,
music. Wow, gosh. We're so lucky to live in Auckland, aren't we? And some people think that we're so lucky to live in Auckland, they have to travel around the country telling everybody else how lucky we are living in Auckland. Hey, Brendan, so you're a part of the best, biggest,
the best
brightest.
Comedy, the best comedy show on earth with Best Foods Mayo.
Best Foods Mayo.
Best Foods Mayo, who are genuinely the greatest sponsor I've ever worked with.
Yeah, it's so cool.
They sponsored the entire comedy festival. Every single comedian walked away with 8 things of mayonnaise.
Yeah.
Which is the best mayonnaise.
It was the best mayonnaise. Yeah. And they're not just paying me to say that. No. But the tour is going to be great. Yep. It kicks off next week. There's 6 acts per show, 6 of the best New Zealand local comedians around the country. I am also me. Unbelievable.
I said yes
to come in again, Richard, and then you've turned on me. The tagline is hundreds of jokes, thousands of laughs.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and I will be providing upwards of 4 of those jokes.
Nice.
It's going to be fantastic.
Now, we know the toenail one, so I'm really curious to come along and see how that resolves, actually. What's your partner's name? Can we say it on the air?
Yeah, it's Alice.
Alice. Hi, Alice. Sorry.
Hi, Alice.
Sorry, Alice.
Hi, Alice, and I'm not sorry.
Yeah, looking forward to hearing how you dealt with that.
The Auckland show, if anybody wants to tag along, is at the Bruce Mason Centre.
It's only one night, eh? So they've got
one
to get
night
in.
In Auckland?
Yeah.
And you can get tickets at comedyfestival.co.nz.
Yeah.
And if you know anyone in Oamaru or Invercargill, I'm really looking forward to Invercargill. We're playing the Civic Theatre, which I assume is just a replica of Auckland's.
Yeah, it'll be a smaller down version because there's less people there. But Invercargill's a great city. Those old theatres, it's new.
Yeah,
cool.
Because when you hear the Civic Theatre, you think it's an old building that's been around for so long. But well, good luck with that. And Oamaru. And Wellington?
Wellington, playing St James Theatre.
Palmerston North,
playing the Regent Theatre.
Oh, that's a great old theatre, Regent.
Those are the ones that I'm not doing, to be honest. I'm not doing Wellington, Palmerston North and New Plymouth.
So they gave you the South Island gigs?
Gave me South Island and the Upper North Island.
Upper North. So we're in the Upper North?
Upper North, we're doing Whangarei on next Wednesday.
Yep.
And then Auckland on the Thursday, Tauranga on the Friday, Hamilton on the Saturday, and then Rotorua on the Sunday.
The Tron. Doing the Tron.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Well, good luck. Good luck with that.
Hey.
Have a great time travelling around the country.
It'll be good. Real fun. This is going to be 6 comedians in a van.
I know
what could possibly go wrong.
This is what worries me. It could just, I hope you get to the venues.
We're going to be very, very dusty. It's going to be
very driving?
Hard. Don't use up all your jokes.
No.
That's where we're going to write the jokes.
Yeah, are you going to test them out on each other as you drive along?
That's the best thing about being friends with comedians is you sit around, you banter, you throw out jokes, and then if you say a good one, you're like, that's mine.
But there's a start. Did you hear about the six comedians that travel around the country in a van? Yeah. Bang. There's your opening. You can have that. There's a whole show, isn't it? It's called
the
best.
A lot of mayonnaise.
Yeah. Do you like mayonnaise?
Love mayonnaise.
Yeah.
Big fan of mayonnaise.
Yeah.
If there's one thing I want you guys to get out of tonight,
it's mayonnaise.
No, it's probably Glory Jeans does good coffee. But also mayonnaise is very good.
Is mayonnaise, I say, best mayonnaise on what? Quick sample. Mayonnaise?
Sourdough.
White bread and ham.
Oh,
that's very white bread.
Yes.
With lots of butter. Lots of butter.
My word, just straight, just on a spoon.
Aroha.
I'd go to the Mark, white bread and ham.
The best potato salad, use best mayonnaise.
Stole my one.
Yeah. Potato salad.
Yeah, potato salad.
Okay.
Leftover turkey from Thanksgiving dinner sandwiches.
Mm. Yes. See, I say coleslaw, mayo and coleslaw. We have a fight in our house because my partner, she likes to put lemon juice on the coleslaw. And I just like to hook on the mayo and the kids. And then the kids.
I'll tell you what, who does a good lemon flavoured mayonnaise? Best Foods. That was one of the samples we got. Very good.
Hey, look, this has turned into a cooking show. Well, thank you for joining us on Cook Arts. I've been your host. We're sponsored by Best Mayonnaise, the best mayonnaise, and the best little comedy show. Hey, look, thank you so much, Dawn, for coming in. First time review was great. Georgia, it's always been a pleasure.
Oh, Kia ora.
Thanks for coming and rushing. You've had a really busy day and supporting Kick Arts, the great New Zealand Auckland art show, Auckland's comprehensive art show, brought to you every Sunday night. Now, we're going to have this available as a podcast 5 minutes after we go off the air. All the little engineers in the background who work very hard at Planet FM are going to be putting it all together and stitching it and taping it. So you can, 5 minutes, download it and share it with your friends. And if you like the show, that's what you need to do. And if you don't like the show, then just send it to somebody you don't like. Don't tell them what it is. And we'll be back next week. We've got another big full show next week, coming to the end of, it'd be the beginning of September, the beginning of spring. Spring has sprung. We've got all those lovely freesias all over our front lawn now because spring's here a bit early. You wouldn't be able to tell by the cold today. So, and just by the way, it's my birthday on Tuesday.
Happy birthday!
Is it your birthday on Tuesday as well?
29.
Oh, well, there
I
we go.
I might have remembered that.
Where last year.
Michael Jackson.
Sir Michael Jackson. I think he's been knighted, hasn't he, since then? But yes. So between now and next week, I'll be a whole year older. So, and not any wiser.
Finally 26.
Finally 26, I've got out of adolescence, I wish. It's almost the second time I've got out of adolescence in my life. So, yes, thank you so much to all the guests. It's been a fantastic show. Good luck with your projects. Good luck with the festival, Going West Festival, and good luck with the Corn Festival and the best mayonnaise thing. We're all looking forward to that. Georgia, have a good week. And we'll see you here. And you're coming back next week, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
Yep.
Yeah, radio's about talking lots. Yeah,
it's gonna be good.
Yeah, and you can see why she's my co-host. So we had a great time. I really look forward to seeing you all in front of your radios and your computers and your podcasty things next week here on Kick Arts. If you're working in the arts, keep it up. It's a great profession. Work hard, go hard, go out and kick some arts. Shabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba-dabba